This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hey everyone, I'm Kelly Behrens-Brink from True Crime IRL, and I'm going to tell you a story about a murder that happened in 1996 in West Cork, Ireland. A French woman named Sophie Giscon de Plantier was found dead, beaten to death, in the driveway of the countryside home she owned there. Sophie lived in Cork part-time and spent much of her life there in an effort to sort of get away from the limelight that she was in France, being married to a famous film producer there. Very quickly, the focus of the investigation turned to one man, journalist Ian Bailey, who covered the case and was one of the first reporters on the scene. The Ireland government has never charged Bailey with any crime. However, in France, they did, and he was sentenced to 25 years in French prison for Sophie's murder, but he's never been extradited back to France to serve that sentence. And this is what we're going to discuss today. Welcome to the show, Elisa Rose. And Elisa is one of Ian Bailey's most outspoken advocates for his innocence. So she's going to talk to us about the case today, a little bit about her background and how she became affiliated with all of this. So welcome, Elisa. I'm glad to have you here. So yeah, why don't you introduce my audience to you and tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, thank you very much for having me. So yeah, I've been working in the media in one way or another for about 30 years. I got into the media, I wanted to be a singer actually, but I didn't make it as a singer. So I had to look for another career option. So I've always been very fascinated with not listening to the news or reading the news, but making news. So I decided that I would become a publicist. So that's what I did. I have a background of, shall we say, creating controversial stories, maybe wacky and off the wall kind of publicity stunts. Mm-hmm. That's kind of my speciality. I'm known for it. Mm-hmm.
That's fun. I would love to hear more about all that.
Yeah, one such that I suppose that the most famous one is the ghost pirate story, and people can Google it if they want. That went viral. I think 15 million views. Yes. On one video. So yeah, but there's been several smaller scale ones. So to put that in perspective, that is like one facet of my work, but I'm also an activist. So, and this is probably the end of me, I suppose, or the part of me that people don't know as much. So, I mean, I do take on serious cases as well. I've done one about sudden infant death syndrome. I've worked on one to do with puppy farming, puppy mills. I've done a huge one about ageism, for which I got 100,000 supporters for that one. An Irish celebrity had been fired from a TV show because of her age.
Okay.
So we started a big anti-aging campaign, you know, I suppose focused at women of a certain age in the entertainment
That's
business.
Great. But yes, I want a lot of more light shed on that topic. I think that's really important, actually.
You know, the clock's only moving in one direction, isn't it?
Exactly.
You know, so we're all getting there, you know, at our own pace.
Yep.
So, I mean, that was a huge one. So, I mean, yeah, I've done serious campaigns as well. But again, I'm kind of more known for the wacky stuff, which honestly was great and it's fun at the time, especially when you're younger. But again, as you get older and more mature, you want to be recognized for your serious accomplishments, more so than all the silly crazy stuff that you did. I stumbled on this case kind of by accident, in fairness, because it was lockdown, you know, as you can imagine, there wasn't really a lot happening in the entertainment business with artists or events or anything like that. So after several months, I was kind of bored, I guess. And I decided that I was going to put a bit of work into my own YouTube channel, which is called Elisa Rose, if anybody wants to look it up. I don't have that many subscribers yet because it's only in its infancy. Although I have the YouTube channel many years, I never really put any videos on it. I just used it for research. So I was just making random videos, I guess, about things that had affected me in my life. I was a victim of Munchausen syndrome when I was a child. So I did a video about that, and it's left me suffering with anxiety as I got older. So I made a video about that, and I made one about menopause. And I mean, it got to the point where I didn't have any more medical conditions really to make videos about. So I needed content.
Yes.
I needed other content. So like yourself, I'm sure I'm very interested in true crime.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff about very famous cases in America, like Lisa Lam and, you know, my kind of namesake, so to speak. Even some famous White House Farm, the Moors Murders, English ones. I searched long and hard on Netflix and Amazon Video, and I really couldn't find much about Irish crime. So I was like, that's something maybe that's not really being explored. Now, this is before the two documentaries that are out now.
And I wanted to talk about those too. We'll talk about those here in a little bit. There's a Netflix documentary and then another one, and they're kind of a little bit biased, I would say. Maybe at least the Netflix one is a little bit, I think.
So. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, we can talk about them for sure. Yeah. So I did, at this point, I think I was going to do 10 or 12. So I had done my 10 or 12 and I picked some well-known Irish murders and missing people's cases, and then some not so well-known. So I had more or less kind of wrapped it up, and we were coming out of lockdown when, as you say, it was actually my father. He said to me, have you done one about Sophie Tosk and the Panty? And I was like, no, I am familiar with the case, but I actually haven't done one on that. And he was like, you know, there's a new documentary. He directed me to the Sky one first, which is the Jim Sheridan one.
Yep.
So he said, you know, there's a great one. I watched it. It's really good. You'll love it, because he knows I'm into all that sort of stuff. So he's like, you'll absolutely love it. He said, I binge watched it. So I was like, well, I was really excited. You know, I'm looking forward to watching this. So, you know, sat down and put it on. And like he said, I was kind of hooked, and I just binge watched it over two nights. There's five parts. So coming away from that documentary, I very much felt that the suspect, who's called Ian Bailey, and we'll go into a bit about that a little later, but I felt very much that he was innocent. But I didn't feel that passionately about it. It's like watching anything else on Netflix. It's like, I think he's innocent or whatever, and just, you know, move it on. So then I discovered there's actually one just came out on Netflix as well. And I was like, well, that's a bit odd to have two on two major platforms at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, right, sure, I'll just stick on the Netflix one. If it's exactly the same as the other one, you know, I don't really have to bother watching it. So I stuck it on. I suppose within the first episode, what really struck me is that it was coming at it from a completely different angle. Mm-hmm. And this fascinated me because obviously publicity is all about creating angles.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how you create a story or create controversy. You need to look for an angle. So the fact that this was presenting an entirely different set of circumstances really to you. So if you watched the Netflix one first, you would have possibly potentially came away with a completely different take on the whole thing. This really fascinated me. So of course I watched the rest of it. And of course at the end of the Netflix one, I'm here, I don't know now. Maybe he is guilty.
The Netflix one definitely kind of steers you into that direction, pointing more towards Ian Bailey's guilt. I actually have not had the chance to watch the Sky documentary yet. Where can I find that? Actually, I do want to know where I can find that one.
It was actually supposed to be out on NBC this month, but for some reason I've been told there's a bit of a delay on it. So I'm not sure when it's coming out now, but it will be coming out in America, but it's not out yet. So
that one's been harder for me to find, but the Netflix one is, you know, easy to find for anyone who wants to watch it. But it is, like I said, kind of one-sided. So beware of that.
Yes, beware of that. So so now I'm sitting here like with the same murder case on one hand saying I don't think he did, on the other hand I'm saying yeah, I think he did it. So yeah, I was like, well, I have to look more into this now because I don't like inconclusiveness.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So
yep,
I looked to see kind of what information, research material was out there, and I came across a West Cork podcast. Now that is something that you should be able to access. Yep. It's on Audible.
Yep.
So that's very, very detailed. So I started listening to that, and that is very, very detailed. So again, after listening to that, I was very much coming away with the feeling that he was innocent.
Yes.
At this point, I said, you know, I've done so much research and spent so many hours of my life watching all this. I think I'm just going to make a YouTube video, but more of a reaction video, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Because there was no need for me to really tell everybody about the case, yeah, because it was out there so much. And in Ireland, it's in the papers nearly every day.
That
so
case.
I didn't really need to train people. So I kind of did more theory type of video, you know, where I kind of, you know, did a reaction on it and give my own thoughts and theories on the case as it went along.
Yeah.
So obviously my theory was very much based around the fact that I didn't think he was guilty at this point after doing a lot more research apart from the Netflix thing.
Yeah.
So when I had it all done, I decided that for some strange reason, I don't even know really why, because I'm not really the type of person that would normally just kind of add random people on Facebook. Yeah. I just kind of said, look, I have a lot of theories in this video. And I suppose, to be honest with you, I did feel a kind of empathy with Ian Bailey. And mm-hmm. I'll go into that, I guess, in a second.
Yep.
So I reached out to him and I sent him a friend request on Facebook with just a little message telling him that I thought he was innocent, and I'd made a Facebook video, sorry, not a Facebook video, I'd made a YouTube video about it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really even think probably that he would actually accept the friend request, because I'm sure he gets a lot of crazy people adding him and stuff. Mm-hmm. So, but he did, and he replied back and thanked me. I thought of the idea about the campaign that I'd ran before, particularly the one about ageism that I've mentioned. Because that garnered a huge amount of publicity, and mm-hmm. it was a very successful campaign. So I just happened to, you know, because we were messaging back and forth, and I just happened to say, oh, do you remember the Linda Martin or the Linda's the Star campaign? Because mm-hmm. it was me that ran that. And he said, I think I might remember. He didn't really know a lot about it. So I explained to him what we did and how we ran it. And I was like, what would you think maybe about running a campaign, you know, for you?
Mm-hmm.
And then he was, well, yeah, you know, I like the idea.
Yeah.
So I just said straight out to him, because I'm a pretty straight talking person, and I just say it straight out. So I said, you know, well, what do you want? What is it that you want to happen? And he said, well, I'd like to see a reinvestigation. Well, actually, at the time, he said, I'd like the cold case reopened. But since then, we have spoken to the police, and they have actually informed us that it is not a cold case, that it is still considered an active investigation. So mm-hmm. we kind of had to change the wording to make it a reinvestigation rather than a cold case investigation, mm-hmm. because the wording was slightly inaccurate.
Okay.
So he wanted a reinvestigation from the get-go, right? Mm-hmm. Go right back to the beginning and start all over again, so to speak, as best you can after 25 years.
Yeah.
So I said, right, okay, let's do it.
Yeah.
So that's where the campaign sprang from. So I suppose to talk about maybe the empathy end of things. So to go back, I suppose, to the empathy end of things, and maybe the reason why I felt like I wanted to run a campaign for Ian Bailey as opposed to many other people who've been convicted wrongly of crimes. And we all know, I mean, there's loads of people. I've reached out to an organization called Falsely Accused Day, and they do a lot of work trying to raise awareness of people that are falsely accused. And it's not a terribly rare thing. It happens a lot.
Oh, it happens a lot. Like, it's in the US, it happens a lot.
The reason, I suppose, why I felt maybe that I wanted to do this for Ian Bailey more so than some random person was because a lot of the reason, and I suppose we'll get into that when we start to talk about the case, mm-hmm. a lot of the reason I feel why Ian was blamed for this crime and why he has continued to receive a lot of the hate that he gets is because Ian is not neurotypical. And he would admit himself, I'm not saying this, I would say this to his face, he's eccentric. He's quite eccentric.
Yes.
And I know what it's like, particularly I know what it's like now, but imagine going back to 1996. In Ireland, in a super rural community, mm-hmm. and to be eccentric, well, you were considered like a lunatic, you know.
Oh, totally.
I'm eccentric. I'm different. You know, I'm not neurotypical, and anybody who knows me or familiar with like lots of the stuff I did will know that I'm not. So I've been there, done that. And this is in a, like, for me, it was 2017 and 18. Mm-hmm. I mean, so you're talking about going back to 1996. I can imagine what it would have been like for him. Mm-hmm. So I suppose because of that, I kind of maybe felt a little bit of a parallel situation. Okay, thankfully, I never, you know, I never got accused of a murder. But had there been a murder in the village where I was living, I'm pretty sure they probably would have thought that I did it, because they thought I was a devil worshiper.
You were the witch of the, like, the Salem witch trials. Like, you would have been burned at the stake, figuratively. But yes, absolutely. I understand what you mean. Yep.
And we actually had a party in the house for one of my daughter's 16th birthdays, and we had a Deadpool impersonator. Oh. And they actually rang the police and said that I had a paramilitary in my house, and it was a Deadpool impersonator.
Oh my gosh.
So, you know, we had the helicopter up over the house and piles of cop cars like arriving at the surround of the house for a Deadpool impersonator.
That's ridiculous.
So it happens.
So do you want to talk a little bit about the actual crime that happened in West Cork in 1996? Maybe just fill people in if they haven't seen the documentary. So it was December 23rd, 1996, like I said before in the intro. And Sophie, she was from France. She was married to a really high profile film director from France, but she didn't like being in the limelight. She didn't like all the attention that that garnered, and she would have her holidays in West Cork. She bought a home there kind of in the countryside. She liked that quiet life. She spent a lot of her time in West Cork. That's just where she liked to be. But December 23rd, 1996, she would be found dead in her driveway. She had been beaten to death brutally. And they didn't have a lot of suspects at first. It didn't sound like they did interview people, but this is like a really small community. Am I right? Nothing like that had ever really happened before.
Yeah, it had been 100 years since there had been a murder
wow.
in that area. 100 years since there'd been a murder.
Wow.
So as you can imagine, the local police had no idea how to investigate a murder.
No.
And of course, it's the day before Christmas. So the whole forensic team, which were in Dublin, they were the nearest team. They were in Dublin.
It took
and
a Dublin, whole day for them.
The geography knows at that time there was no motorways. You're talking about maybe 6-7-8 hour drive from Dublin to get down to this remote area.
Yeah. And I read it took 28 hours later, they finally showed up and they had left her body out in the elements.
They couldn't even ascertain the time of death or anything accurately, because it did take them over 24 hours to get down, because they had been all out for a birthday party and a Christmas party and all this. So by the time they got down there, I mean, there was very little to be found in the way of forensic evidence. Yeah. Having said that, they did find some fingerprints. They found some hair on her, and they found a little tiny spot of DNA on one of her boots.
Okay.
But apart from that, very, very little. They did not preserve the evidence properly. There was a whole gate, like a massive, huge farm gate that had blood on it that just kind of disappeared, and nobody really knows what happened to it.
There was
a lot of miscommunication, like about the black coat is a big thing on Netflix. So the black coat, apparently, Ian used to wear this long black coat all the time.
Yes.
And apparently there was evidence given by one person who said that they had seen it soaking in bleach all over Christmas because they had stayed at Ian's home. Okay. But yet he's seen in a video wearing it on Christmas Day.
That doesn't add up.
It doesn't add up. No. Of course not. And then in another part of the documentary, you have a police officer saying, we searched the house, we never found the coat, we believe he burned it. But then later on, you see some files of evidence, and you see clearly that it has been documented that this coat was actually found, and that it had been cut up and sent away for DNA to see if there was a DNA match with the tiny bit that they found, and it didn't match.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got like a lot of miscommunication here between different departments, because they didn't know what they were doing.
They did not have the experience that they needed for that kind of crime.
No, they didn't. In the beginning, they had absolutely no idea why anybody wanted to kill her. You know, she seemed to be like well liked in the locality. There was some talk of marriage issues, but the husband was ruled out because he had an alibi. She had a previous lover who was ruled out because he also had an alibi. Mm-hmm. It was considered that perhaps it was a hired execution because the husband was to gain a large insurance policy and the rumors that he was having an affair.
Yes.
And now bear in mind, I think she was certainly not his first wife. She could have been a second or third or maybe even fourth wife. I don't know. He had a bit of a history for having a lot of wife.
Yes.
But the police ruled that out because they said a hired executioner would not have found the house because it was in such a remote area. But I don't see how you can rule something out that easily, because if you're paying somebody, I don't know how much hired executions cost, but I can imagine
they pay a pretty penny for that. Yeah.
Exactly. So if you're paying somebody that amount of money, they are going to make it their business to find out where that person lives.
Yes.
That's the job.
I mean, and everyone in the area knew kind of where her home was. I think it would be pretty easy to find her.
Yes. And she had been out and about and in the pub. I mean, she could have been easily followed.
Yeah.
There was another case that early that morning, now when they did the post-mortem, they found like breakfast cereal, like muesli, in her stomach, which would indicate that she had been killed in the morning as opposed to being killed, you know, during the night.
Yes.
But again, they could not ascertain the death and the time of death. But early that morning, around 7:30 in the morning, somebody that was driving to work had been overtaken at great speed by a blue Fiesta. And that would have been unusual for people to have been driving that erratically at that hour of the morning in that country area. And he even remembered part of the number plate of the car. And he went to the police. They never even explored that avenue. So there's loads of leads that they never bothered to explore, because very early on in the investigation, they decided that it was definitely Ian Bailey, and they put all their resources into trying to ensure they had enough evidence to prove it was him. Yes. So they didn't really explore any of the other things. And that's part of the reason why I have an issue and why I say it needs to be reinvestigated, because all of the other things that were not investigated, they need to go back and start looking at them. And I know it's going to be really hard after 25 years, and there may not be a conclusion. It's too long. But at least it does give Ian Bailey reasonable doubt.
Exactly. And I think you need to look into these things further. I mean, so many years have gone by. Technology has improved. There are a lot of other things that were overlooked. And I just think definitely they owe it to him to take another look at it with fresh eyes. I think it always helps, you know, to have a new set of eyes look at things when decades have gone by.
Absolutely. So, I mean, look how many cold cases have been solved by reopening them after many years. And as you said, a fresh pair of eyes on them. You know, there's been loads of developments in forensics. I mean, they do have a piece of DNA that was too small to use back then, but it probably wouldn't be too small now.
Now they could
need very much DNA.
They could work with it now.
Ian did voluntarily give his DNA back then.
Yep.
He wasn't forced, before he was even ever arrested, he volunteered his DNA, and it didn't match at the time anything that they had. And he is absolutely positive that even with the advancements, he's positive that his DNA will not match. And another thing I would say to people is, when I asked him, I suppose maybe it was a little bit of a test, what do you want? And he said, you know, I want to clear my name. I want it to be reinvestigated. Now, if the person really thought that there was some possibility that they could be caught for this, or they could be found guilty of this, why would they want the case reinvestigated? To me, that doesn't make logical sense. You'd just let sleep in God's lie, wouldn't you?
I feel like, yes, exactly. He would just, you know, he's living his life. He's not in prison right now. You would think he would just disappear quietly and let it go, but he's not doing that. He's outspoken about his innocence. He wants his name cleared. He wants to be vindicated. And that, you know, that says a lot, I think. Yeah.
Well, to me it does. And especially wanting it to be reinvestigated, because I mean, imagine if you had committed that crime, and you know that forensics have came on so far, and you're like, I mean, maybe there was just a little strand of DNA there. You wouldn't want them to go back and comb over everything again. You really wouldn't.
And he's been very cooperative, which it says a lot on his behalf as well. So
so I suppose maybe to tell people a little bit about why Ian Bailey got the blame, I suppose, is maybe the next thing that we should look at. Ian was British. He was English. He's not Irish. At that time, there was still a little bit well, maybe more than a little bit, animosity between Ireland and England because of the division of Northern Ireland.
That's something a lot of Americans don't know a whole lot about, but I've been learning that as I've been podcasting with other people in Ireland and other places. So yeah, that they're definitely,
I suppose, to simplify it, Ireland had been taken over and ruled by the UK for many years. There was civil war for a very, very long time. Eventually they came to an agreement where there would be 26 counties, which are kind of like states, that would become the Republic of Ireland, and that Britain or the UK would keep six counties or six states, and they would remain part of the UK. And that's called Northern Ireland. The other is Southern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland.
Yeah.
Now, Northern Ireland is divided. So you've got people who want to remain part of the British Union, and there's people who want to be in the Republic. So you've still got rivalry, and you've still got friction there, even to this day. But back in 1996, it would have been a lot fresher and rawer than what it is now. Obviously, with the new generations coming up, people are getting different priorities, and it's not as important to many people as it was back then. So Ian had been living his life over in the UK. As I said, he was from there. He'd been married. Marriage hadn't worked out. It had been quite acrimonious, and he was just going through a tough time. He was a journalist, an investigative journalist, and very well known, very well respected, and apparently top of his field in the area that he was working in.
Yep.
But when the marriage and everything broke down, he kind of lost his way, I suppose is maybe the nice way of putting that. He just was a bit lost. So he had holidayed over in West Cork a couple of times, and like Sophie, had fallen in love with the place. And he had decided that he was going to just take a break from his life and just move over to West Cork. I don't know at that point if he had intended that it was going to be forever or maybe for just a few years. I know he wanted to write poetry, and he wanted to write a couple of books of poetry. So I think that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to take a couple of years out of his life, move over, write some poetry, I guess, maybe, and see where his journey took him.
So kind of reinventing himself a little bit.
So he moved over to West Cork. Now, Ian had always been a little bit eccentric in his dress. So he used to wear long black clothes, big hats, scarves, bandanas, you know, maybe a bit of kind of Johnny Cash going on, a little bit of John Wayne.
I can relate to that.
Cowboy look,
You know, we can relate to that with our tattoos and everything, right? And wearing black and stuff. But yeah, I can relate to that.
Yeah, but I suppose he would have been, you know, well, I suppose maybe back in 1996, you know,
woman very with different.
Completely tattooed arms maybe wouldn't have been like, you know, very acceptable. It's a lot more, you know, normal in a way, normal. But back in 1996, Ian, to be honest, the way Ian dresses is still a little bit eccentric, but even by today's standards. So rewind to 1996 and here cowboy comes into town, you know, and they're all like, who's this? You know, who does he think he is?
You know?
And he's very tall. He's 6'4". So he's like towering over everybody. He's got a very loud voice. He talks very loudly. So here he is like coming in here like with his like cowboy look, and he's like so tall, and he's going into the pub and he's standing there, who wants a poem? You know, and he starts reading off his poetry, and everybody is like, you know, in this small little farming, small community, they're like,
who are you?
I don't want to curse, but they're like, what the F?
Oh, you can curse. That's fine. Oh, yep.
You don't want to demonetize. They're like,
I gotcha.
You know, and so, let's put it like this. He didn't try to fit in. He has always been himself.
Good for him.
He's never tried to change. And why should he change?
Yeah, no, good for him. Yes. I love
a lot of people that had moved there, you know, did try to fit in, but he just didn't. He was like, I'm me, take me as I am, you know, I don't care.
Yep.
So he didn't do things to endear himself to people. People thought he was arrogant, theatrical, full of himself, you know, narcissistic is another word that's thrown around. So people didn't like him. Yeah. And, you know, while people are perfectly entitled not to like everybody, you know, you can't, that doesn't make you a murderer just because, you know, you're loud or arrogant or whatever.
Yes.
So, a lot of rumors started to go around the place. And again, you know, I know how this happens. Ireland is shocking for gossip and rumors. So there was rumors that he had naked poetry readings on the beach, you know, where he's reading to like poetry to 10 naked ladies. Well, actually 10 naked lesbians was said. Okay. They knew they were lesbians, I'm not really sure, like, because honestly, the last place you'd find lesbians is hanging around the naked man, really. But
that is a good point there.
yeah, for real. Like, but you know, so some guy watched too much Pornhub, I think, you know, or something,
oh my gosh,
and just got that idea in his head, you know. Another one was that he howled at the moon, and people had seen him going out when there was a full moon, and you know, there was rumors that he thought he was a werewolf.
Yeah,
like crazy stuff.
But that does not make someone a murderer.
If you've never spoken to a person and you're reading this, I mean, before I spoke to Ian, I've read all of this, and when I got to talk to him, I was like, is he really this crazy? Like, you know, and even though, you know, being crazy still doesn't make you a murderer,
right?
You know,
exactly.
But I was expecting him to be actually a lot more eccentric than he is, really. So I mean, all of these rumors started to fly around. So after Sophie's death, the police, again, like we said, they didn't have a clue. So they'd ruled out the husband and the hired executioner. They didn't bother following the car because I guess they didn't really know how to do that.
Yeah.
So they started asking around the locals who might have done it, you know, and, you know, anybody that would have had a motive or blah, blah, blah. So the name that they kept getting up again and again was a madman who lives in the town, who runs around with naked lesbians, who howls at the moon, who's like very tall. He'd be tall enough and strong enough to do it. And his name's Ian Bailey. Yeah. So that's really, again, it was gossip and innuendo. That first brought him into the picture.
Definitely.
What didn't help as well is that, like I said, Ian's an investigative journalist. Mm-hmm. So there was no journalist in that little small rural area. So as soon as this story hit, and it was big news at the time in Ireland, the papers in Dublin wanted a journalist close to ground zero. So they knew of Ian.
Yeah.
So they had contacted Ian and said, look, can you get us some stories, do a bit of digging around, you know, that's what you do as an investigative journalist. So he was like, okay, sure, I'll do it. So he kind of inserted himself into the story. So he was up at the crime scene, he was going around her house looking in the windows to see could he get anything, you know that he could get his exclusive.
He did story. Exactly what an investigative journalist is supposed to do, a good one. He did his job well, and he was the first one on the scene, basically, and he started covering the case very in depth. That is what he was supposed to be doing. So he was doing what he was there to do. Yeah.
Exactly. And I find even now working in the media, ordinary people don't really get the media. You know, they take everything at face value. They take everything very literally that they see on TV. They don't realize that reality TV really isn't reality TV in the most part. Yeah. So they're kind of seeing Ian up at the crime scene. They don't really know that what an investigations journalist is supposed to do. They see him looking in the windows and trying, you know, to ask questions, and they're like, that's suspicious. So again, this kind of all fed more into the fact that, you know, was definitely him. So within a few weeks, the guards had absolutely 100% decided that it was Ian, and they set all their resources into trying to prove that it was him. When it came to kind of be known that he was a suspect, the editor of the newspaper that he was writing for rang him one day and said to him, Ian, do you know that you're actually a suspect in this?
Yeah.
And he was very shocked, because I will say that Ian is not very good at picking up on social cues. Now, he's never been diagnosed, you know, as being non-neurotypical or whatever, but he doesn't have a filter. He's quite a dark sense of humor, and he's not good at picking up on social cues.
Gotcha.
So he thought this was so ludicrous. He was like, yeah, of course I did it. I needed a story.
And that's a joke.
I personally think that's hilarious. Well, yes. I heard that on the net. I think, I don't know if it was Jim Sheridan or Netflix. Like, I first started laughing because I've got a very dark sense of humor. I mean,
me too.
I do. I have a very, very dark sense of humor.
As a true crime podcaster, I've made lots of jokes like that, exactly the same. So, yes. Yep.
Unfortunately, other people had heard this, and they went to the guards and said, look, he's made a confession. He said he did it for a story. So then they arrested him and they said, look, you've confessed this crime, so you need a story. And he's like, that was a joke. And they were like, was it a joke? I don't think that was a joke. So they took it as a confession. And another, he had said something else about another black joke about bashing her head into some other guy who also went to the police and said, look, you know, I mean, yes, in bad taste, perhaps that one particularly was in bad taste. But again, it, you know, it doesn't make
it. It was a joke. Yeah, maybe not the best.
No matter how much in bad taste.
Yeah, yeah.
So he was arrested a couple of times and they started to build up a case. Like I said, you know, mostly met out in gossip and innuendo, you know, Mary down the road said she saw him doing this and Jim up the road said this. And they had multitudes of witness statements talking about how crazy he was. And then I suppose the biggest one, and this is probably the most famous witness statement in the whole thing, is Marie Farrell. Marie Farrell was a married woman who owned a shop in the town, and she had initially gone to the guards and said that she had seen a man. Sophie had been in her shop the day before she died, and she had seen a man wearing a long black coat across the road, almost stalking Sophie or certainly watching her. He had sallow skin. He was about 5'8", wearing a beret. Now, of course, berets are very connected to France. So I mean, the first thing I think, if she said to me, I saw a man that's kind of, you know, sallow skin with a beret, I think that sounds like a French dude.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm not picking Ian Bailey here, you know?
Yeah. Plus, so he's about a foot too short almost, right?
Absolutely. He's far too short.
Yeah.
So she'd gone to the police with this. Then she had actually been out with a man who wasn't her husband the night that Sophie died.
Yes,
and she'd been driving along this road, and there's a bridge called Hailfather Bridge. Mm-hmm. And she claims to have seen a man in a long dark coat, similar to the man she saw in the shop, kind of almost standing by the bridge, almost as if he was washing himself or doing something shady anyway, shall we say.
Yep.
So I'm not going to go into a whole story, but, you know, she'd lied to the police and given false identities and all because she didn't want her husband to know she'd been out with another man. But anyway, they tracked her down and they found out it was her. Now, initially, she didn't say it was Ian Bailey. She was describing a different, I suppose, description. The only thing that really linked them was the long black coat.
Yes.
But the police started telling her, look, we know it's definitely Ian Bailey. We have all these witness statements. Like, we just need to place him near the crime. You can do that with this bridge story. So, you know, just sign here that it was Ian Bailey because we're sure. So they kind of talked her. They also bribed her with her husband had some driving offences that they said that they would drop as well if she went along with it. So she signed the statement to say it was Ian Bailey. Mm-hmm. Now, she kept this up like for years, like for 10 years. And then after 10 years, she finally decided that she couldn't live with herself anymore. So she came out and she told everybody it was bullshit.
Oh.
It wasn't true at all. She had been the man, but the original statement that she'd given of the different description was the truth.
Yeah.
And she was absolutely sure it wasn't Ian Bailey.
Wow.
So...
earth-shattering.
Anyway, we'll rewind just a little bit here because all of these witnesses, including this one now, before she retracted it or anything, all of this was sent to the DPP, which is the Department of Public Prosecutions here. Mm-hmm. So this had all gone to them twice, and twice they threw it out. They said there's no evidence, it's circumstantial, there's absolutely no evidence here to try this man. Mm-hmm. We're not taking it to trial. So they just dropped it. But what happened, and again, people who've watched the documentary will know this, Sophie had a teenage son, he grew up. So fast forward, you know, 20 years later, the son is not really letting go of this. And you can certainly understand that. He lost his mother at a young age. You know,
he wants answers,
he wants closure, he's not getting it.
Yeah.
So he starts to put a lot of pressure on the French to launch their own investigation. So eventually the French requested the guard the files from the Irish state, and they were given them.
Yep.
But the issue that I have with that is that they were given the original files, including the statement by Marie Farrell, which had since been retracted.
Yes.
That's a problem. All the innuendo about him messing around with naked women, howling at the moon, and all this crazy, crazy stuff that anybody who's reading this, who's never spoken to Ian, is going to be reading this, and it's painting a pretty crazy picture, a pretty bleak picture, a picture of perhaps a man who is insane enough to be able to do this crime.
But that stuff really doesn't belong in a crime report, a murder file. Like, it doesn't really belong there. I don't feel like stuff about his.
No, because it doesn't connect.
Does not make him a murderer.
Right. You know,
yeah.
There's no evidence to prove that he ever even knew Sophie or spoke to her apart from seeing her at a distance. So
really,
they were just
incriminating him with personal details that were, you know, eccentric and things like that. Things that were not the norm. Just kind of painting him in a very bad light.
Yes, and a very absolutely. So, so the French are seeing all of this and they're reading all of this. And the more they're reading about this, the more they're getting convinced there's nobody else could have done it. It must be him. Just the guards didn't have enough evidence.
Yeah.
So in France, and this is the thing that I suppose that is most unique to this case, that in France, they have a law. It dates back to the time of Napoleon, whereby if a French citizen is murdered anywhere in the world, that they can try the suspect in France.
Okay.
But not only can they try the suspect in France, they can try that person in absentia. So that person does not even have to be at their own trial.
I wondered how that came into play. I didn't know that, because how could he be convicted if he wasn't even at the trial? I kept wondering that. Yeah. So that's where it's at. Okay.
The trial. They also accept things like hearsay, because in that kind of trial, it's also known as an intimate trial. You've got three judges and they base their decision not on hard evidence, but on their own feelings, whether the person did it or not. So that kind of is totally contrary to the model of innocent until proven guilty and beyond reasonable doubt, which is a model we work on here and there.
Yes, and here too. I mean, that would never fly in the United States. That would have never happened. No, that's not a little crazy.
And we're not talking about some remote island here. We're talking about a first world country.
Right, exactly.
This can take place in progressive modern country. If it happened in some island, you know, in the Caribbean, I'd say maybe so or whatever. But like, honestly, like, this is a big country. This is not somewhere that has tribal law.
That puts it into so much better perspective for me, because I was thinking, well, he's been convicted of the murder, but really, I would not call that a trial, like, as I know a trial in the United States or anywhere else. That's really not much of a trial. So
yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, that's the way I would say it. You know, that's certainly not a trial that I could take seriously, or that I believe serve the course of justice, because it goes against. I mean, I would very much, you know, believe in, you know, innocence of proven guilty, that you have to prove things beyond reasonable doubt.
Yeah.
From watching all the crime programs and all the all that kind of stuff that I've watched, you know, I think that protects us as a whole. It protects our human rights in a way, you know.
Definitely.
It protects our freedom. To have a trial like that is very contrary to human rights and to our basic right to freedom, I think.
I agree. You know, I don't even call what happened a trial. I just think they just wanted to pin it on somebody, and that makes a lot more
sense.
Yeah,
they just wanted to get closure for the family, in my opinion. And I can't say that legally. That's my opinion, that they wanted to close the chapter on it for the family.
Yep.
You know, that's the trial in itself. That's not even taken into account that the decision that they made in that trial, which was to convict him and sentence him for 25 years, that was based on inaccurate information. So take that and add that into the mix as well. That it wasn't even an up-to-date file that they were working on.
Right.
So he was convicted. He was sentenced to 25 years, but Ireland refused to extradite him because, again, we don't recognize that form of a trial.
Yep.
So Ireland felt that it would be unethical to extradite him on that basis. So it went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and it would appear that at this point Ireland is not going to extradite him. So while he stays in Ireland, he's a free man, but he can't leave the country. He cannot even, I live in Northern Ireland, so I live in the part of Ireland that belongs to the UK. So he would not even be able to come up to this part of Ireland, because technically he's entering a different country. So he can never leave Ireland.
Wow, he's a prisoner.
So although he's not in a prison, he hasn't his freedom. He hasn't the full extent of his freedom.
So where, and his family lives in the UK, correct? Okay.
Yes, his family lives in the UK. His mother died and he wasn't even able to go to her funeral, which is
very sad.
Yeah. It is very sad. In fact, France are kind of still saying, look, you know, we've convicted him, he's guilty, we want him to go to prison. And Ireland is saying, well, we really don't want to bother reinvestigating it, but we'll, you know, we'll just let him stay the way he is now and we'll not extradite him. So we won't make him go to prison, but we're not going to really try and help clear his name either. Public opinion is very powerful. People do not realize the power of the media and the power of public opinion can change things. It can change history. I've seen it.
It has changed the face of so many cases with people who have been wrongfully convicted, people advocating for their freedom to look at the details of a case again that don't make sense. And there have been lots of people who were exonerated based on that kind of information. And so there's a petition that people can sign. So if people agree that there's not enough information to have convicted Ian Bailey in France and that it should be dropped or reinvestigated so that he can have his freedom back, there's a petition they can sign. Tell me a little bit about that.
Okay, so we've got a petition on change.org, but change.org, you have to sign in all your details, like they ask for donations and stuff like that. So we set up a Facebook page as well. So we kind of say, look, you can like the Facebook page if you want to give a show of support. If you just want to keep an eye on things, but you don't want to give your support, then, you know, you can just follow the page. So there's the petition and there's the Facebook page. Now, a lot of people have kind of said, look, the support on the Facebook page is a bit questionable. It wouldn't stand up in law. But what I'm saying to people here is this is not a legal thing. Consider it more like a poll of public opinion that I am going to present to the Garda Commissioner. Because again, like I said, it's just to put the feelers out and see what public opinion is and then to pass that on to the relevant authorities.
So what have you found? So what is the popular public opinion on this case? What do the majority of people think about Ian Bailey's guilt or innocence?
I would say, honestly, what I find is 50-50. Very polarized here and people seem to have very extreme views on both sides. So the people who support his innocence and who think it should be reinvestigated are really passionate about it. Mm-hmm. But the people who are on the other side of the coin and who think he did it, mm-hmm. they're also very passionate. So in all my 30 years in the business, I have to say, I have never seen a case that had such strong feeling and such friction. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're talking about supporters going against supporters. I mean, just take a look at Twitter. It's crazy. Yes. There's so much hate there and so much, you know.
Well, there is anyway. It's toxic. Kind of a toxic place. Yes, toxic. Exactly.
Toxic.
Yeah.
Really toxic. Yeah. I mean, it was quite shocking. When I took on this case, I did not realize that there was so much friction and so much polarization of people's opinion. I knew obviously there were people who thought he was guilty, but I didn't think that emotions ran so high on the case. So it's definitely been a massive eye-opener to me, and it's certainly been an experience that I will never forget.
So Alisa, what do you think about I think I know what you think, but who do you think did it? Do you have a person in mind, or what are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I obviously don't think Ian did it. I mean, I've got to know Ian somewhat over the course of talking to him to do with the petition and stuff. And I mean, the more I've got to know him, the more I'm absolutely convinced he didn't do it. I really just don't think he has it in him to do it. So I'm absolutely convinced he didn't do it. Mm-hmm. There are certain things about Ian that I can understand why people don't really like him. And that's okay. You know,
you don't
I
have to like him.
Nice
but,
guy.
Yeah.
I happen to think he's a nice guy, but then, you know, I happen to get on with maybe people that other people wouldn't always get on with. But I definitely 100% don't think he has it in him to commit a murder. Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. My theory on it, although it has been presented to me from somebody else, one of these, you know, internet sleuths, you know.
Oh, yeah.
It has been presented to me a very good case for it to have been that person driving the blue car, which I can't say too much about because it is still being investigated. Mm-hmm. But despite that, I still am going to stick with my original theory, which is I think was a hired execution.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that's very interesting.
From my research in the beginning, that's what I thought. Yep. One of the main reasons as well that I thought that too is her husband, after she died, after she was murdered, her family came over to identify the body and to look after the body and bring it back to France. Her husband never came to Ireland.
I know.
The memorial service that her family held for her, he didn't even go to.
Right. There was definitely some fishy behavior on his part, some stuff.
If you love somebody, mm-hmm. like, there's no way you're not going to go if that person that you love is being murdered.
Yeah, there was some suspicious behavior on Daniel, the husband's part, after Sophie's murder. I read a lot about that. So there are just so many possibilities in this case. But as we know, in the true crime world, when someone gets brutally murdered, and this was seemingly a very passionate crime, there was a lot of emotion behind it. It typically is, you know, someone closest to the victim. It's very rarely random. So there's just a lot to be looked into. And in interviews that Ian has done, and like with Maurice, our friend Maurice from Cheap Heat Productions, and just other various interviews, he doesn't strike me as a cold-blooded murderer. That's just my first opinion of Ian. He just doesn't do it for me, really, in that way. I don't know. It's my gut instinct that he's innocent.
And especially if you're even talking to him on a one-to-one basis, mm-hmm. which obviously I have been, you know, through video calls or whatever.
Yeah.
You just kind of realize, you know, very soon into a conversation, you're just like, no, as you said, it's
very
just
hard to believe
with me that he has that in him. And that's my own personal gut feeling, obviously. You know, that's not going to stand up in court. I don't think he did it. But,
yeah.
you know, to me, he doesn't fit the profile of a cold-blooded killer.
I agree. But so where is he now? He is in Ireland. He cannot leave the country. He's basically stuck here. He's not in prison, but he is a prisoner, if you're really being technical about it. So
His whole life has really been ruined, in essence. I mean, you know, nobody wanted to work with him way mm-hmm. back in the day. Like, his journalism career was over. It took him years to try and get his books published. His relationship with his partner broke up. He's, you know, barred from loads of places in the area, like pubs, restaurants. He gets refused service. He gets refused at him on the street. And like social media, he's only recently joined social media there a few months ago. And Facebook now is not too bad for trolling. Facebook have cracked down on trolling big time. Twitter is like a cesspool. I mean,
Twitter it's
crazy.
It fights and toxicity.
He literally gets hundreds. I'm not even talking about two or three comments a day or tweets. You know, I'm talking about he gets hundreds of hateful tweets every single day. And unfortunately, up until very recently, so did I. So, and anybody who comes on to say that they support him, the trolls are all on them. And, it's nasty, really nasty stuff. Now, I'm all for free speech. I am the biggest advocate for free speech.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a difference between free speech and hate speech.
Oh, definitely. Yes.
You know, mm-hmm. and the stuff that's being tweeted is not, you know, you have a different opinion to me, that's fine. You think he's guilty, that's fine. You're entitled to do your research, look into the case and have an opinion. And I respect that, even if it's different to mine.
Yeah.
But what isn't okay is to go on and start talking about somebody's appearance, somebody's religious beliefs, you know. All this kind of
nothing to do with the case.
That's nothing to do with the case.
Yeah.
No. If you can make a case for debate based on fact, then keep your mouth shut. Yeah.
It's just an unintelligent rambling of someone who's wanting to stir up the pot, basically.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I've just no time for that at all.
No, me neither. So do you have any final words you want to say? I want you to leave everyone with your, you know, contact info, like where to find you on social media and where, you know, again,
where they can find the petition on change.org if they want to sign that?
Well, yes, I would say if you type into Facebook or even into Google, Justice for Ian Bailey, you're yep. probably going to get the Facebook page as a suggestion or the change.org. It's up to yourself. If you're happy enough to put in your all your details, like your email address and your home address and all that, absolutely, you can go to change.org. If you want to just be more, a bit more anonymous, just go to the page and give it a like. There's lots of little small videos and news articles on the page, so if people want to go down the rabbit hole a bit more than we've had a chance to go. Because, I mean, this is a massive case. We've got 25 years of goings on. So, I mean, we've only
so much.
You know, this is the tip of the iceberg here. So, I mean, there's a lot more that people can go into. There's lots of information, videos and news links and all that on the page. If they want to contact me, I'm Amanda Large on Facebook. That's my real name. And my company is Elisa Rose Publicity. So both, again, are on Facebook. Okay. And I'm happy to talk to anybody that that has any questions or wants to interact with me in an intelligent, respectful way. I'm happy to talk to people. I'm also on Twitter, Elisa Rose Ireland, and Instagram too. So yeah, on all social media platforms. Yeah,
great.
And then don't forget my YouTube, where it all started.
Yes,
which is Elisa Rose. And it's a variety of content there. So I mean, go on yes. and have a look through and
definitely, you know, check that out.
Solve if you like it.
Very entertaining. All sorts of stuff on your YouTube.
All sorts of stuff. Yeah. Oh, yeah, you've got stuff like about, you know, the Titanic conspiracy, and you've got stuff about medical conditions, and you've got crimes that shot down, and you've got about How I Met Eminem, and you've got like all these kind of different stories from my yep. life that are kind of yeah. into little videos, you know.
So everyone check that out. Now, do you go by Amanda or Elisa or both?
My actual name is Amanda Large. So Elisa Rose is kind of my stage name.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I just kind of want to separate the two in a way. Yep. And I do have two very different parts of my personality. So when I'm Elisa Rose, I'm all like, you know, like I am now. Yep. And when I'm Amanda, because I am autistic, you see. So Amanda okay. is actually a lot quieter, and Amanda is like a lot more of an introvert. And that's how I can understand the introvert extrovert, because I'm trying to keep my private life a yep. bit more private by kind of going with Elisa Rose. Yeah. And that's the name of my company. So,
yeah, that works. That's great. Thank you so much for coming on my show. It was just a joy, a pleasure having you. This case is, man, so many rabbit holes. It's so interesting. There are two documentaries out right now. There is Sophie, A Murder in West Cork. That's on Netflix. And then the other one is on the Sky Network, I believe. What is the yeah. name of that one?
And that's called Murder at the Cottage.
I would suggest going with that one first, and then maybe.
Yeah, and certainly keep an eye out for when it's coming out in America, because it yeah. will be coming out. So, I mean, just keep an eye out on it, I'm sure. Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure. Thank you. Brilliant. Again, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. Have a good weekend. We'll see you soon. Yeah. True Crime IRL is written, produced, and hosted by Kelly Behrens-Brink. We are part of That's Not Canon Network and TNC Productions in Brisbane, Australia. For more information, go to truecrimeirl.com. True Crime IRL theme music is produced by The Captain at True Crime Garage. Thank you.